Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Members were today I've asked the fiscal analyst Gary Carter to provide us with a brief overview of some of the changes in the governor's budget proposal based in part on the federal stimulus package. From there we will hear from the Office of Justice Programs and the Commissioner from the Department of Public Safety on the federal stimulus package, the dollars that come under the purview of our division, how they might get used, and then we will hear from some of the programs that we have funded before and some that we haven't. Who may also be eligible for those federal stimulus dollars. So with that, Mr. Carter, can you give us a brief overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we still do not have the change item pages, the detailed pages coming out from the Department of Finance or the Office of Budget Management. They said they should be coming out, I think, early next week. So we just have a very brief, like a one-sentence description from the governor. The first one is corrections, the Department of Corrections. Here the governor is recommending that the department take back the short-term offenders, and basically the department will need about a little over $4 million each year for that, to take back the short-term offenders. I think they're estimating that around 300 short-term offenders. The courts, the Court of Appeals, the District Courts, and the Supreme Court, the governor is reducing that reduction that he had in there by $10 million. The one thing I should point out, though, that the reduction does not include civil legal services. It's just for the rest of the Supreme Court and the District Courts and the Court of Appeals. This will bring down their reduction to about 3.3%. Remember, they had about a 5% reduction. And I should point out one other item. This is just one-time funding, so it will be only for fiscal years 2010 and 2011 with no tail. Also, on public safety, there's two items that we have, and this is under the Emergency Communications Network grant. There's a $5 million grant to local units of government associated with the ARMOR program, and the funds would be available to local units of government that are eligible for the local enhancement grant passed by the legislature, so the locals can buy some equipment. It's $5 million, and this is state government special revenue. This comes from the 911 fee. It is a one-time appropriation. The next one is also on the same program, and it uses 911 special revenue funding to build the next generation of internet protocols. And I think Mr. Wiggins talked about this before, and the appropriation is about 3.4 the first year and 6.5 million the second year. And one other appropriation in 2012, the first year of the biennium after the next, and that is around $3 million. Those were the only change items, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Are there any questions on the governor's change items? Representative Olin.
Mr. Carter, just to get a verification, now that $4 million per year to take back the SGOs would be in addition to the money would be there already, which would have been the 1.6 whatever they're given to us.
Mr. Carter.
Chair, Representative Olin, you are correct on that. There is their base funding, I think, is $1.607 million for short-term offenders.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, we have our work cut out for us. So let's move into the federal stimulus package. I don't know who wants to start. Assistant Commissioner Ellison and Ms. Beauvair from the who is the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Program. You know, Assistant Commissioner, I've met with Ms. Beauvair in my office, and I found that the whole process for the federal stimulus to be a bit on the complicated side. So I think it would be helpful if you carefully walked us through that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Olson. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. We'd be happy to walk you through it, and you're right, it is a bit complicated. What I'm going to do this morning is just give you some overall parameters of what we have been given in terms of the purposes and how we are to administer these grants, and then Ms. Bolvar, who's Director of Office of Justice Programs, will walk you through more of the details of each of the funding categories and the purposes for which they can be used. The stated purpose of the Recovery Act is to preserve and create jobs and promote economic recovery. The general guidance that we've received so far from the Office of Management and Budget directs the recipients of all Recovery Act funds to administer them with unprecedented transparency and accountability, award funds in a prompt, fair, and reasonable manner, ensure that the recipients and uses of the funds are transparent to the public, ensure that the benefits are reported clearly, accurately, and in a timely manner, ensure that the funds are used for the authorized purpose areas, and ensure that program goals are achieved, including goals on broader economic indicators, and that really means how many jobs are saved or created as a result of the stimulus funds. The state of Minnesota will be receiving over $32 million from the Federal Office of Justice Programs in one-time Recovery Act funds, and those will be awarded through three formula grant programs. And these are programs that we already administer within the Office of Justice program. So we're used to administering these funds and granting them. However, they are a one-time addition to the normal grant funds that we administer. The first one is the Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program. We used to refer to these as the Burn Grant. The name was changed to Justice Assistance Grant, so that's now the Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program. The total amount of money that's coming to the state of Minnesota under this program is $29,157,427. The Bureau of Justice Statistics calculates for each state a minimum base allocation which can be enhanced by the state's share of the national population and the state's share of Part 1 violent crime. 60% of the allocation is awarded to the state to administer, and 40% is awarded to eligible units of government. So when we get to the $29 million, $11 million of that is awarded directly from the federal government to local units of government. So our state agency really has nothing to do with that. It's a formula. It's awarded directly to local units of government. That means that we have about $18 million that will be coming to the state of Minnesota Public Safety Office of Justice Program to administer. With the Victims of Violent Crime Act funds, the total is $1,213,897. And the Violence Against Women Act, Victims of Crime Act funds, I misspoke, is $1,213,897. And the Violence Against Women Act funds total $2,304,272. So that's the overview. I think it's been a little bit confusing to people because, we've been told that $29 million in total is coming to the state of Minnesota. However, 11 of that $29 million goes directly from the federal government to local units of government. And we certainly have a list of all of the local units of government that are going to receive those funds, and if you haven't had that available to you, we certainly can make that available to you. So then that leaves over $18 million for the state to administer in the Burn JAG program, and then in addition to that, we have the VOCA funds and the VAWA funds. So Ms. Bolvar is going to kind of walk you through the details of each individual program.
So the money going to local. So that's all, that would be like police departments who could apply, courts, I mean, who, are you going to go through all that, Jerry? Okay, then I'll just...
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, too, the money that's going directly to the locals, they don't apply, it's just going directly to them in a grant program, and Ms. Bolvar can give you even more details on that. It gets confusing, so maybe we'll have Ms. Bolvar kind of walk through it again.
Okay, since it is confusing, if we can hold off, we have a couple questions. Let's see if we can figure this out, and then we'll get into the questions. Ms. Bolvar, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can clarify that last question. You do have the list of local recipients of those funds. They do have to make applications directly to the Bureau of Justice Assistance to receive those dollars, and they can spend those dollars on any authorized JAG purpose area, which includes all the components of the criminal justice system. you'll note on the list of recipients that you have there, some are in shaded areas. Those are what's called disparate counties, and those people all have to get together and apply under one application and sign a memorandum of understanding among them to distribute the dollars.
Can you explain how that, so these are all cities or counties that have got, that have received this money before, is that what you're saying?
Not all of them have received it before. Due to the size of the stimulus fund, additional jurisdictions have received dollars this time. But I would say half of them have received direct allocations before.
Okay. Let's see if this question is at this particular point. Representative Severson, is it on the...
Yes.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question in terms of this is coming directly from the federal side to the counties. Number one, is there, I guess you were kind of nibbling at this, but is there a current system that they're using in appropriation? How are we getting the information to those county units that there's a timeline on this and the procedures in which they have to go through in order to get that enacted?
Ms. Beauvais.
Mr. Chair. The applicants have been identified or have been contacted directly by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. We are also making contact with each of the individual agencies to let them know that the grant is available and we're assisting them in their applications.
And Mr. Chairman, and so the deadline or the timeline that they're required to comply with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think their applications are due, I want to say, April 18th. I can get that specific date for you, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. You mentioned the shaded group goes right to, they apply right to the federal government. The unshaded group, what do they do?
Let's go there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the shaded groups actually have to get together and make one application.
Oh.
And apply directly, everyone else applies directly as well.
Thank you. And then the other question is are, as we as a state, are we able to see the application to see what programs they're spending the money on, kind of a pseudo audit maybe a little bit, just to see kind of what they're using their money on and that we're not, you know, the state funding kind of a similar program for them if they're using the federal dollars?
Ms. Beauvais.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we were asking each applicant agency to submit their applications to us so that we're aware of it. In the request for proposal process that we're going to put up, we're going to ask applicants to define what they've applied for at the federal level as well.
Okay, one final thing, Mr. Chair.
Let's see, Bigham.
Thank you. And will you be able to make that available to this committee? So that
still there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Lai.
Thank you, Ms. Beauvais. The most typical agency applying for these funds in the past, the police department, and other than police departments, what are other agencies that are making these grant requests?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that half of them are primarily for law enforcement agencies, but there have been a variety of uses of these funds, prosecution efforts, community prosecution in St. Paul, prevention programming, drug courts, they've used it across the criminal justice system.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the testifier. How do you pronounce the name?
Beauvais.
Yes. Thank you. I guess kind of following along the same line of questioning as Representative Bingham, I want to know a lot more about this because I think our challenge as a committee is going to be, obviously, with our big budget problem, we want to be able to make sure that we have a good mesh between this money that's going directly to the local governments and what we would be doing from here. So I'm kind of wondering, first of all, what's the timeline for these applications? Are they going to get to you and then you get to us the information in time for us to make some decisions around that? And then are there any strings attached to this money, either to the local governments or that would tie our hands in terms of doing that sort of, you know, any kind of maintenance of effort requirements or anything like that?
Ms. Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the timing will be close. The applications for the locals are due in mid-April, I believe, and we'll get those applications together as soon as we can and get them to you. They do not, the locals do not have to have a maintenance of effort clause, but they do have to follow the federal regulations for each program that's out there, as well as comply with the hiring and economic stimulus package. So those would be the strings that be attached to it. But the timing, I think, is challenging.
Okay, you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With just so I have an understanding, I'm going to use my example of the city of Cottage Grove, which gets 27. I'm wondering if they can use that for any part of this, that lump sum, or do they have to target it to one aspect, or can they divvy it up and be diversify? I think that's a recommendation by most investors. I'm just wondering if people are able to diversify.
Well, there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they can allocate these funds to any authorized purpose area under the Justice Assistance Grant Program.
Okay, do you want to finish telling us about the programs?
I will, Mr. Chair. I'm going to start with the JAG program, which is the most complicated and the largest program. The purpose of the program is to reduce or prevent crime by providing support to all components of the criminal justice system. JAG-funded projects may address crimes through provision of direct services and by improving the effectiveness and efficiency of the criminal and juvenile justice system processes and procedures. The funds can be used for state and local initiatives, technical assistance, training, personnel, equipment, supplies, contractual support, information systems, and evaluation of any programs that meet the purpose areas. As Deputy Commissioner Ellison indicated, we have a little over $18 million available at the state level. These funds are available for up to 4 years, but of course they're encouraging us to use these soon in the spirit of the Act. We can use up to 10% for administration, and this is where it gets further complicated. 65.72% must be passed through to locals. That's about... just about $11 million as well that has to be passed through to locals. That leaves about $5.5 million that can be used for state initiatives or local initiatives. The authorized purpose areas are law enforcement, prosecution and court, prevention and education, correction and community corrections, drug treatment programs for offenders, and crime victim and witness programs. It's our plan to distribute these funds through a competitive RFP across all the purpose areas. Student guidance has been thus far, if competitive means were used in the past, they would be expected to be used for the recovery funds. We'll have an external review process for these funds, and we anticipate doing two-year awards, estimating from October 1st through 9/30/11. There are special conditions on these dollars we cannot supplant. That means we can't replace state or local funds that have been appropriated or allocated for the same purpose. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is doing their best to be as liberal as they can with the supplant provision, acknowledging the difficulty that states are having. They have been defining this as, if a program was cut in 09, we can use these funds to replace it. And if it's on the chopping block, not defined, for 10, this is also an appropriate use for the funds. There are going to be special reporting provisions that are fairly complex and quite timely. Programs have to employ best or evidence-based practices, and they have to improve or reform the criminal or juvenile justice system. The Victim of Crime Act funds were created to provide direct services to victims of crime. $368,897 we will receive for compensation payments to victims of violent crime, and $845,000 for direct service to victims through providers. Up to 5% of this can be used for administration, and these funds are available from 10108 to 9/30/12. How we're going to use these funds is the compensation funds will be used to cover loss of wages and loss of supports for victims of crime through our current claims process. The direct services funds will be integrated into our annual crime victim application process, and we can use this $845,000 to offset the reduction of the $963,000 of one-time funding that we received last year. Again, the special conditions are no supplant and also special reporting provisions. The last part is violence against women, the SAP program, services, training, officers, and prosecutors. This program promotes a multidisciplinary approach to addressing violent crimes against women, including domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and dating violence. It encourages the development and strengthening of effective law enforcement and prosecution strategies and the development and strengthening of victim services. Up to 10% can be used for administration. 30% has to go to direct service to strengthen or expand programs for women. 25% for law enforcement, 25% for prosecution, 15% for American Indian programs, 5% for the courts. The timeline on this particular program is extremely short. These are only available for 24 months and the clock starts 5/1/09. So funds will be available from 5/1 through 4/30/11. They must address one of the 14 SAP program purpose areas. We're going to distribute this through a competitive RFP process and again 22 to 24 month awards. Again, no supplant. MAP is required on these programs, but we have applied as a state for a waiver because we're quite sure we can't provide that. MAP required, and these also have special reporting provisions. The staff at OJP have been extremely busy developing the applications for these programs, developing the RFPs and specialized reporting forms for each program, getting information out to the locals, posting things on our website, and fielding calls from the direct applicants and helping them with their applications. I also gave you one more handout, which is just a table of other justice competitive funds, just for your information so you have it maybe for constituents. Given the spirit of the act and the tight timelines, the VAWA RFP will be posted on our website by the 1st of April and the JAG RFP by the 1st of May, with those applications due June 30th. Happy to answer any other questions you might have at this time.
Ms. Rivera, I was trying to get at what, so this whole issue about not supplanting, and then you in 09, and then I thought I heard you say projects that perhaps were on the chopping block in this biennial budget. Is that what I heard you say? I mean, in other words, like I noticed in the governor's budget and corrections, he is not funding restorative justice programs. Would that be something that would be on the chopping block that would potentially be eligible for, I guess, JAG funding?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And then also, if would JAG funding be eligible for expansion of drug courts?
Mr. Chair, that is correct as well. They'd be an eligible applicant.
So would that have to be specified then? We couldn't make a recommend. And how was that going to work? Would the legislature, through rider language in our omnibus bill, make a recommendation to OJP, or would the courts have to apply? How are we all involved in this?
Mr. Chair, that's a difficult question. Up until this point, these funds have been distributed through a competitive RFP process, and that is the recommendation from our federal administrating agency. So it's a difficult question you ask me. We hope to distribute this through a competitive process.
Through the competitive process and the separation of powers, I'm just curious as to how that might work with the court applying to an agency for funding to do a, something well within their jurisdiction with the separation of power issue. I'm just not sure how that all fits together, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bovair.
Thank you, Representative. The court has been a recipient of grants from us in the past. They are an eligible applicant for JAG funds.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either Ms. Bovair or Ms. Ellison, the sheet that you gave us includes the website contact information on each particular area. We do not have our website contact information for against violence prevention and prosecution programs and internet crimes against children. Is there one? How can people find out about those two areas?
Ms. Bovaire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are waiting for the information on the prosecution, who's going to be putting that money up. The Internet Crimes Against Children, there is only one eligible applicant for those funds, and that's the City of St. Paul.
Follow-up, please.
Warner.
Okay, so thank you for that answer. And Ms. Ellison, you at the initial testimony said that one of the hopefuls that it will create, I'm going to read my notes here, save and create jobs. Can you tell us approximately how many would be created and how many would be saved?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't give you that number right now. That is one of the things that the federal government is requiring that we collect for reporting purposes. So when we make the grants to agencies, we will be asking them to report on how many jobs were created as a result of this, how many jobs were saved that would have been cut as a result of this, so that we can report that to the federal government. However, at this point, unless Ms. Bovaire can correct me, I don't think we have a good estimate of that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bovaire, you mentioned one of these buckets of money having a matching attribute to it, and you said we might have an exemption. Do any of our dollars then that we transfer down, are we going to require any matching?
Ms. Bovaire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no,
we're not. A lot of these cities would, if police departments are applying for this money, I mean, what would they typically be, what would be the use? Is that to add an officer to do a specific thing, or is it a technology upgrade? I'm just trying to, obviously we're trying to think of how we can make all of this money work in these difficult times, so I think it's been intimated that we don't want to be duplicating services, so if there's anything that the cities can do in the interim that can take some of the financial pressure off the state, we'd like to hear about it. So I don't know if you can answer that question or not.
Mr. Chair, we've got some initial information back from some of the applicants, and how they're using the funds are really quite varied. What complicates this even further is there's $1 billion at the federal level available for cops, replacements, or creation of jobs. We are encouraging all of the departments across the state to make application for those funds for personnel in hopes that maybe they'll apply for those for personnel and maybe come to us for equipment upgrades. But I think the needs of each local department are really quite varied.
Mr. Killer, did you have another question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to follow up, Ms. Bovaire, how much of that money was matching, and how confident are you that we would get that exemption?
Ms. Bovaire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're fairly confident. They encouraged us to actually make application for the waiver, and it was a 25% hard cash match.
Thank you. Any other questions at this point? Okay. We'll probably have more questions for you. But right now we're going to hear some testimony. Again, some of these organizations received state funding in the past. So why don't we start with Scott Beatty with the Youth Intervention Programs Association. And it'll just take about 5 minutes. We've had you before the committee before talking about YIPA. Why don't you give us an overview, and then we'll see if you're eligible for the federal stimulus dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Beatty, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association. I do want to direct you to a packet that you've got in front of you that's got the YIPA logo on it. Just to kind of give you a little brief background on the Youth Intervention Program, which I'm representing today, it currently consists of 66 community-based early intervention programs throughout the state of Minnesota, providing approximately 20,000, our services to approximately 20,000 kids. Currently, the appropriation during this current biennium is $2.4 million. part of that $2.4 million a year, of that $750,000is one-time funding that was appropriated in the last biennium. I think there's a number of things that we can talk about in here today. And I've mentioned this before when I came before the committee, that there's a social return on investment research project, research study that was done by Riley Research and the University of Minnesota that shows that these programs are, they have a return of investment of almost $5 for every dollar invested. If you need the community, these particular programs all need to come up with $2 in community funding for every dollar they get from the state. So if you use that, those community dollars, the FROI is actually $14.67 for each dollar invested. There's other research out there, of course, for Vanderbilt University economist Mark Cohn, who calculated that for every youth that drops out of school and takes up a life of crime and drugs, costs the taxpayers over $2 million in the lifetime of that particular youth. So I think the dollars, I think it's real easy to show that the dollars are there. We know that for every $100,000 of the youth intervention program, that it provides approximately 500 kid services, early intervention services. And we also calculated that for every $30,000 that would be lost in the youth intervention program, so for instance, if the governor's proposal to bring the youth intervention program back to the old base funding, it would probably be about 25 jobs that would be lost within the youth intervention industry throughout Minnesota just with that $750,000 that would be cut. We know success rate has been high over the 30 years of this program. It's averaged about 90% success rate in keeping kids from further involvement in the juvenile justice system. So we know the program works. We know that, you know, it uses mentoring, counseling, education to work with these kids. So we know it saves the state money. We know that if we can keep kids out of the juvenile justice system, we know it works. So, and I know you folks understand this, and I've been in front of you enough to kind of get that. I know you get this. So what we were asking for, we had a bill that Representative Biggin had sponsored and many of you folks had co-authored, asking for $2.4 million, which would basically try to keep the funding at the current level. We also know that with the current economic state, without the stimulus money, that's probably not going to happen. So why I'm here today is to really talk about our hope for the stimulus money. And let me give you my ideas, or our ideas, our YIPA's board and our membership. Through this JAG burn grant, it seems to me like this is a perfect fit for that kind of money. OJP already knows these organizations, the 66 organizations that are receiving this funding. They have grant managers already set up for these programs. They know what they do. It's a collaborative. YIPA provides training. We work together. We do all sorts of program sharing, best practices. We're even working with OJP right now on improving outcomes, so we have some better measurable outcomes. So we have a really good relationship with OJP, and I think many of you know from conversations with me, before this whole stimulus, or this whole economic crisis came, OJP was in favor of bringing that $750,000 a year in one-time money to the governor and asking him to put it in the base. Now that didn't happen because of the problems with the economy. But from our perspective, it just makes sense to be able to use some of this money rather than, and I know what OJP is trying to do. They're going to ask each one of these organizations to apply individually for this money. And I do want to say some of my concerns about that. Some organizations are better at applying for this money than others, especially the smaller Organizations, the Greater Minnesota organizations, have a difficult time. They don't have the resources. It costs a lot of money to apply individually for this kind of money. It's kind of a crapshoot whether they're going to get it or not. There's a lot of competition. It puts them against each other. In RFP processes, believe it or not, larger organizations that have development directors and have the time and staff actually have a better shot at these monies, where organizations like culturally specific organizations have a more difficult time. They have language barriers. They have difficult times with that. So from our perspective, it just makes sense that, and again, it's transparent because, and I know JP is worried about the transparency part, but from our perspective, it's very transparent because they're already working with these organizations. These 66 organizations are already getting youth intervention funding. So what we would be asking for is to supplement the money, the $750. We're not asking for any more than that over this period, this two-year period of time, so that maybe, in hopes that during the next legislative session, we can come back. Maybe things will be better. Hopefully, will be better, and we can work on hopefully trying to get some of this one-time money back into the base. So
Mr. Beattie, you have $2.4 million in the base budget, and the $750,000
Mr. Chair, it's 1.65 in the base, and then the per year. So they added $750,000 a year, brings it up to 2.4.
Up to two. Okay.
So what we would be losing if the governor's proposal stuck, we would go back to the 2006-2007 biennium amount of 1.65 million. That's if it sticks, you know. And we know that the Department of Public Safety is also being asked to cut some of their budget, so we don't really know if that would go down or what would happen.
So based on this, on the federal stimulus money, it says your intent then to apply for the $2.4 million.
We don't really know what our intent would be. Hopefully the legislature could at least provide what the governor is asking for, which is $1.65 million. That was the old base.
So there, can you help us out here? I'm just trying to get at the logistics here. I mean, I think that this legislature has been supportive of YIFA in the past and wants to continue. So what's changing here with the process?
Mr. Chair, the base funding for the YIFA grant or the YIF grants is about $1.6 million each year. They received a one-time increase for the biennium of $750,000. So the 1.6 remains in the base, but the one-time amount didn't carry through.
Okay, and can the YIPA programs apply for the additional $750,000?
Mr. Chair, my concern with that, just applying for the, I think the application would be quite complicated, because they'd have to make a case for each program meeting the program requirements, in addition to handling some very complicated reporting. I also think that the field ought to be as open as possible for other prevention and intervention initiatives that are not represented by YIPA.
Okay. Representative Cornish.
Ma'am, while you're up there, Mr. Chair, I've got a feeling that in a year we're going to wish we never would have taken any of the stimulus money, but as I travel around with these different committees, it's unbelievable how creative people are in using this and their interpretations of what it can be used for. My big worry is that, like in your programs, that people are going to put it into personnel, they're going to put it into equipment. Even if they put it into equipment in a one-time purchase, that's going to need maintenance. And then when the stimulus money is gone, I've got this big fear that we're going to fall off this cliff. Our economic picture in the state is going to be the same. And here you've had all this stimulus money and these people and these equipment are sitting there and no way to maintain it. How do you propose, or what's your advice to these different organizations that are getting this money, how to stay out of that trap with no guarantee that it's going to be continued? You get all their hopes up with the stimulus, you bring back all these programs that have been cut in the past and giving more to the ones that are there. How are we getting, does the legislature going to stay out of this dilemma of not having any money and then everybody be disappointed we go through all this crisis again?
So there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I can address this.
that question, but I we're going to encourage applicants to fully understand that this is one-time funding and to be very thoughtful about how they use these dollars and to do some long-term planning if, in fact, they have to have, you know, maintenance of effort to continue them. That's the best advice we have at this point in time.
That's fine. That's good. Okay, Mr.
Chair,
do you want to have
members of the committee, I just need to make a real strong point here is that I really believe that, you know, especially in 2000 and for the next biennium, all these youth intervention programs have to reapply for their money, okay? I don't quite understand why at the time they have to reapply, which would be in September and October, because their funding comes on a calendar year. I don't quite understand why they couldn't apply when they're applying for the youth intervention program to apply for some of the stimulus money at the same time. The reporting is there, everything is there already set up through OJP. Again, very transparent. It just seems to me, again, we understand that it's one-time money, but it would still keep those programs operating. It would still keep those services intact. It would still make sure that we don't leave those services to those kids. You know, which again, if we're talking about reform, we don't want to cut back right now, because in a few years, you're going to be faced with even more dollars if these kids do end up in the system or in jail. So it just, I don't know, I don't quite get why this is so complicated and why it can't be used for that. We're asking for $750,000 a year out of this $13 million. So what would that be? $1.5 million out of that $13 million. So for our 66 community-based early intervention programs already set up, already ready to go.
Robert, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, the only response I have is that the $11 million that will be going to locals will be spread across the criminal justice system. And prevention is one of the categories that people can apply for. And again, having an open process for all applicants to be able to come into the door is the preferred method of distribution.
From what she's saying, Mr. Beattie, it doesn't sound like that precludes any of these organizations from applying.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but our issue is, yes, they will apply, and some of them may get it, some of them may not. Again, it's costly to do that. It's very expensive for an organization to do grants, to request money from the state and to do all those things, when they're already going to be doing it with the youth intervention program. So it seems to me like if there was some creativity, that possibly when they are applying for the youth intervention program in October, that this whole thing could happen. So
that's no close.
Okay.
Ms. Bigham.
This is more a question for Ms. Colbert. Some of these are kind of what Representative Corner said. Some of them have limitations of like up to 10% for administration. I'm assuming that we have no wiggle room to, as far as the state, to impose a tighter cap on that so that we can more target these sorts of programs. And I do get the argument that, well, if you have all these programs, you need people to administer the programs and present the programs. But I'm just out of curiosity, is there any flexibility for the states to tighten that cap to, say, 5 or 7%?
Go there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure you can make recommendations to us. We are trying to develop a realistic budget, and we may not end up taking 10%, but we're trying to develop a realistic budget as to what it will take to do this job right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beattie, for your presentation, and we'll be working on this.
Thank you very much.
Members, we have a quorum, and I would like a motion to approve the minutes of March the 12th. I move. Representative Ward moves the minutes of March the 12th. Any questions? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. I'd like to just give you an update on things. As you may have noticed, that Melanie McMahon is not here. Melanie had a St. Patrick's Day baby, and Brennan Joseph weighed in at 7 pounds, 12 ounces, 21 inches long. She's doing fine. Her husband, Scott, as some of you know, who's a lobbyist here for the private colleges, is also doing fine. It was a little, the timing wasn't exactly the way we had planned it, but you can't do anything about that. So anyway, I just wanted to announce Melanie will be gone for the rest of the session, and Libby Wyrum, as you know, will be the acting committee administrator, and Kate Weeks, who you also know, who provides research, will be assisting with the committee, so feel free to use them as you need be, and I don't know if this is on television or not, and I hope Melanie's not watching and doing something fun, but if you are watching, congratulations, Melanie and Scott. Okay. We'll now hear from the Department of Corrections Reentry Services, Gary Johnson. Are you here? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Committee, I'm Chris Bray from Department of Corrections, Deputy Commissioner.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. With me is Gary Johnson, our reentry coordinator. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We'll be very brief. I would like to talk first about the Second Chance Act, which is a little bit different than what you've been talking about thus far. The Second Chance Act of 2007 came out of a federal omnibus bill. It's Section 101, State and Local Reentry Demonstration Grants. And the purpose is to provide a comprehensive response to the increasing number of people who are released from prison and jail and returning to their communities. Currently, there are about 2.3 million individuals serving time in federal state prisons, and millions going in and out of jails throughout the United States. About 95% of all prisoners eventually return to their communities. So this act is designed to ensure that the transition that individuals make from prison or jail to the community is successful. As a result of the act's passage, the U.S. Department of Justice has issued a competitive grant announcement to fund these demonstration projects and to authorize state and local governments and federally recognized Indian tribes to apply. The application deadline is April 20th of 2009. There are numerous requirements to applying, and I'll just name a few. They include that the entity that applies has to have a reentry strategy that describes a long-term strategy, measurable yearly outcomes, and five-year performance measures. Participants have to be involved in the creation of the strategy, and may include representatives from the fields of public safety, corrections, housing, health, education, substance abuse, children and families, and victim services. Third, there has to be extensive evidence of collaboration with state and local government agencies overseeing the areas I just named. There has to be evidence of the role of local government agencies, nonprofit organizations, and community stakeholders that will be coordinated by and that will collaborate on offender reentry strategy of the applicant. There has to be an extensive discussion of the role of state corrections departments, community correction agencies, and or local jail systems in ensuring successful reentry of offenders into their communities. And there also has to be the establishment of a reentry task force that's comprised of all the relevant state, local, tribal entities, and relevant agencies. And those are just a few of the requirements. The awards are up just $750,000 for 1 year with the option to renew for 2 additional years. So that's the background on the Act. I'd like to spend just a minute now talking about the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Project, because that's our vehicle for the state of Minnesota to apply for the funds. And we just call it MCORP to make it short. MCORP is Minnesota's Offender Reentry Initiative. It's the DOC's vehicle for implementing correctional change in reentry practices throughout the state, starting at the point that offenders enter the institution, following and working with them through the institutional stay, through their community supervision, and up to discharge. MCORP was started in 2003 and began by forming a steering committee that includes state, local, and nonprofit partners. State members include Department of Corrections, Public Safety, DEED, Health, Education, DHS, and Veterans Affairs. Our local government partners include Community Corrections in Hennepin, Ramsey, Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted counties. Those are the three counties where we're piloting best practice in the reentry area. And then our stakeholder collaboration includes nonprofits, a whole series of nonprofits and interested stakeholders in reentry. We call it our Transition Coalition. It's a well-established network of service providers who meet at the DOC every month and who are now starting one in Duluth and just beginning to try to start one in Rochester. So I mention all that just because this overarching structure that we have in place, called MCORP since 2003, allows the state of Minnesota to meet the collaborative requirements of the grant. Without this structure, the state wouldn't be able to apply, but because of MCORP, we have an opportunity to leverage federal funds from the Second Chance Act. We already have done so for a federal PRI grant, and we've already used those funds to get a little bit of foundation support from Annie Casey. Further, the MCORP has a very rigorous research design in place. We use an experimental design. We have an intervention and control group, and that meets the standards of the grant. So I will just end here by saying we are in the process of applying for the Second Chance Act funds, and our proposal to them is that we provide comprehensive services to release violators coming out of our facility at Lino Lakes during the first year of the grant. This would demonstrate the benefits of preparing unsuccessful offenders for a second chance at reentry, an area that we would like to get better at. We would provide case planning, referrals for community services, and grants to community providers to serve that population upon their re-release. We're also thinking in the first year we'd like to begin to develop some interagency agreements with a counties to keep offenders with shorter periods of accountability time in local jails and workhouses so we can keep them closer to their families, closer to the services they're receiving, and closer to their supervising agent. So I will close with that. If you have any questions, I think Mr. Johnson is probably the best person to ask.
Ms. Bray, Assistant Commissioner Bray, so the $750,000 would be in addition to the monies that you currently use for MCORP, or would that be used to supplant the current programming budget?
Mr. Chair, members, we wouldn't be supplanting. We would be doing something different with that set of funds, but it would be under our MCORP umbrella, and the something different would be just focusing on this group of release violators.
And it would only be the Department of Corrections that would be eligible for the money. I know we have some other reentry programs in the state. We made a sizable commitment to the network last year, which also does reentry services. And so would they be eligible to apply, or would they have to go through DOC?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my understanding, the wording in the solicitation is state, government, local government, or Indian tribes can apply. So any one of the three, it's just that structure has to be in place that I described. So it could be a local structure similar to the one we have going on at the state.
But a nonprofit like Network wouldn't be eligible.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would say no.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Bray is correct.
Can you just
correct,
introduce yourself for the record?
Pardon me?
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm Gary Johnson. I'm the Director of Reentry Services for the Department of Corrections. We've had discussions with the Department of Justice about the parameters of this kind of grant. And this section, Section 101, as Deputy Commissioner Bray indicated, is for state and local governments to do demonstrations for reentry. There are other sections of the Second Chance Act that apply to nonprofits, and that would be where the network may be able to find funding if they were to apply.
Okay. And do you have anything else you'd like to add about MCOR or reentry? We canceled an earlier meeting on reentry. We were going to try to look at some of the measurement data on the success of MCOR and the network, but I don't know if you have a couple minutes, if you have anything you want to tell the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We did submit to you some performance measures that we find very promising, and I'm hoping that all members of the committee would be able to look at this. Our comparison is through a randomized study. So this is a pure research evaluation of what works and what doesn't work with what we're doing with the pilot project. So we're comparing an experimental group of offenders against a control group of the same type of offenders. And what we have found is that preliminarily, this is just 1 year data now for calendar year 2008, that in every regard, as we look at various areas that we're studying, the MCOR experimental group has outperformed the control group in every area. Just to give you some examples, in terms of supervised release revocations, the control group has a percent has a 20% rate of revocation hearings, while the control group, or the experimental group, has an 18% rate. So that's a 10% reduction from the control group. In terms of revocations with new offenses, there's a 41% reduction for the experimental group over the control group. In terms of any return to prison, technical violations, or new offenses, there's a 24% reduction for the experimental group versus the control group. In terms of rearrests, there's a 33% reduction for the experimental group over the control group. And in terms of reconviction so far, there's a 29% reduction for the experimental group over the control group. So we're finding, although this is, as we say, very preliminary data, it's very promising data in that in each case where we're looking at issues around recidivism, the experimental group is doing much better than the control group.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I don't pretend to be nearly as expert in some of these reentry issues as you are, and others around the table are more familiar with them than I am, but I have had an opportunity to get to know a little bit more about the network and its program. The question I have for either of the witnesses is, as I understand it, and I think this is correct, if we look at a cost per individual served, the cost of a program like the network is significantly higher than the cost of per individual served for what MinCorp is doing. The question, though, is there anything, I'd like to be able to compare apples to apples. the network is somewhat unique, and they're providing a whole basket of services. And I guess what I'm curious as to whether the department is providing any services to offenders that we could compare, kind of on an apples to apples basis, to make an evaluation as to what works better. It's difficult, obviously, with 1 year of data and, you know, a year and a half of the network being in existence, or at least being in existence with state funding. But if this is the right type of approach, the network's approach is the right type of approach, and we're getting better results, I mean, maybe that's what we should be doing. Or maybe, I mean, it's expensive. It costs a lot of money to do what the network is doing. But if it's having people employed and keeping them out of jail and helping them find a place to live, and maybe that's worth the extra money, and maybe we should be doing more of that, sadly, with fewer men or offenders, men and women, as opposed to, you know, sprinkling around a little bit to everybody. So is there something that Maine Court is doing that could allow us to do some kind of apples-to-apples comparison with this new program we started funding?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, it's very difficult to make an apples-to-apples comparison because in the case of MCOR, what we're doing is demonstration of correctional change, where corrections agents who are working with those people that are released from prison and are directly responsible for a caseload of those offenders are demonstrating some new correctional practices. And it includes some funding for things like housing, stipend money to get bus passes to get back and forth to work, some things that we really haven't done before that kind of compare to what the network does. So there's housing, there's transitional employment through a contract in Hennepin County with Goodwill Easterfield, so that a small number of offenders who are in the experimental group can get transitional jobs. We'd like to expand that. The network does that in that they have a transitional job part to their program. But it's a very difficult thing to compare these two programs. The important point I want to leave with the committee is that they are an organization that has a contract with the department to do a different kind of approach, a holistic kind of approach of services to offenders, and we believe that has great promise. We're still waiting to see what the results are from that particular evaluation. But it's different in that the Department of Corrections is moving towards what most other states in the country are doing. In fact, we're progressive in terms of what we're doing with reentry. We're ahead of a number of states. To fund one program and defund the Department of Corrections means you set reentry back here in Minnesota a number of years in terms of a statewide movement to put reentry practices in place. So I think the network is doing a very good job. They're a great program. They are one of those programs we'd like to have in our arsenal of services for the offenders that we supervise around the state. But if it's a competition between one or the other, I think we have to look very carefully at the fact that the state of Minnesota has a reentry initiative that we intend to expand to other parts of the state, and that would be set back by defunding.
Thank you. I think we're going to take one more if we can, and then we have two more programs that would like to testify, so we could. Did you have a question too? Representative Eastland was next. I would just want to point out, just as a comment on what you said, Mr. I would hope that it not be a situation where there's competition, and I realize there's tight funding, but we made a sizable financial commitment to the network in the last biennium, and to give up on them at this point I think would be shame, and nor should we be cutting back on MCOR, but we'll have to sort all that through because we don't know what. I think you need more time to analyze. We need more time to analyze the research. Representative Eastman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comment, Mr. Johnson, and I too support this program. I think it's something that we need to do. The more people that we can keep out, once they're out, that's another huge economic benefit. I guess just going back to the network and kind of the comparison, I just had a couple of questions. How many offenders have actually been involved in kind of the M-Corp stuff now? And then I guess I'd like you to comment on the difference in the kind of an offender that would go to the network program versus what you typically do in M-Corps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, right now we have data on 269 offenders with the M-Corps pilot project. We have a little less than 300 offenders who have taken part in it and are continuing to be released to this program. We've finished one phase of the program and we're in the second phase. Our intention is in phase two to work back towards the point of admission with offenders and begin to work with them much closer to the first day that they enter prison, which we weren't able to do initially because we had to populate caseloads in the community. So we started with some offenders who were just close to their release date. Trying to remember what other question you may have had. Sorry.
The difference in the type of offender that would go to the network versus typically an M-Corp.
Thank you. M-Corp is working with offenders who have been released on standard supervised release. The network works with offenders both on standard supervised release and intensive supervised release. So they're working with some offenders who are a little higher risk than what M4 is, but there's a great difference between those two.
Representative Stevenson, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this point, and I think the M4 program is a great program, as is the network, but it's only giving us a partial picture because I think it's located in the metro area for large population density, and one of the bills that I'm hoping we'll be able to hear is from some outstate initiatives that would dovetail with the M-Corp program to give us a better picture of a whole state. How does it incorporate into the outstate area as well? And that's just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Quick closing
comment. Our intent, Mr. Chair and Representative, is to expand what we're doing. This is a pilot project, but essentially it's the demonstration to see what works and what doesn't work, so that at the point that we do expand this statewide, we know what the best things are that we should be doing. We have a program called our Transition Coalition, which is a network of nonprofits that meet with us on a monthly basis and get to talk to each other about what they're all doing around reentry. And one of the things we're doing right now, the first step in an expansion, is to put a transition coalition up in Duluth and another in the St. Cloud area. And wherever else we can get that kind of involvement, we'll be expanding that particular part of our reentry initiative.
We have three organizations that want to address this in the next 15 minutes.
Just a quick comment. I know we have a bill dealing with extending CRP this year that I'm the author of, and in my view, this would be a tremendous joint effort. I mean, if the concept of CRP could be also combined here with the reentry services, I think we would score a big goal.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, Deputy Commissioner Bray, thank you for your testimony. We'll now hear from Civil Society, Linda Miller. We're short on time, unfortunately, so if you can make it as concise as possible.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Linda Miller, and I am the Executive Director of Civil Society. We are the only agency in Minnesota that is rescuing international human trafficking victims and treating them as victims under the Trafficking Victim Protection Act. So the victims that we are working with are ones that fit the federal definition for a human trafficking victim. We have been honored by this legislature by receiving your funding and your trust, and we have done absolutely very well with your funds. We have received certificates of appreciation from DOJ in 2002 and 2008 for our best practice method, and we are the only ones in the state of Minnesota who have filed successful U visas and P visas. And in fact, one of our attorneys just was honored for filing the most successful, the greatest number of successful U visas. Also, we have now been awarded, we're going to be featured by the United States State Department in a United States State Department television production on trafficking, international trafficking victims, and how they are to be worked with in the United States. We also have, under the Stimulus Act, we're very qualified to receive funds. I've talked to our grant manager. Our grant manager says that we are qualified under three of the categories at least. We are the only up-and-running organization treating international human trafficking victims as victims. The difference between us and Breaking Free is Breaking Free works with Officer Heather Weicker, and they arrest the victims and then give them services. So we're treating them as victims under the international human trafficking laws. We would save 15 jobs. A lot of our attorneys are here, and they are working for, they work out of their own offices, provide all their own expenses, and they are paid $24 an hour. And this just provides for their mileage, their telephone, and their wonderful, wonderful dedicated work. They've been working with us. We received our first international human trafficking victim in 1998. That's before the Trafficking Victim Protection Act was even enacted. So we've been very helpful in styling it and making sure that it serves the actual victims as they come in. We have now been provided free rent. So in terms of in kind, this was before we got donated free rent. Okay, so this is from our I-990 fund, so it's all out in the federal government, showing that we have the in kind of a match of about $3.9 for every dollar that Minnesota has spent on our project. We serve children, many, many children. One half of the sex trafficked victims in the United States are children, and they come in on illegal visas. They are brought by people on illegal visas. We are working with Hennepin County Attorney's Office. We are working with other agencies to actually prevent traffickers from bringing more child brides into the United States. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Norris. And Ms. Bovair, I take it that Ms. Miller is correct that she that their program fits under at least one of these categories? Okay. Very good. Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Miller. And next, Mary Ellison from the Advocates for Human Rights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary C. Ellison, and I am a staff attorney at the Advocates for Human Rights organization based here in Minneapolis, and I have with me Suzanne Keplinger from the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. We're here to talk to you today about some also human trafficking work that we have been doing. Our organization has published a report on sex trafficking in Minnesota, which addresses trafficking not only under the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act, but under our very own state law, which was enacted in 2005. As a result of that report, some of the recommendations were to strengthen Minnesota law on sex trafficking, and that is the Minnesota law, not the federal law, of course. And so we have put together a package of bills, which we will be having heard tomorrow in the Crime Victims Subcommittee in the House, and eventually in the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side. Two components of that bill. There are four components of the bill. One has to do with strengthening the criminal provisions of our Minnesota statutes 609.321 and 609.322. Another component has to do with training for law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, and service providers on human trafficking, including what trafficking is under the federal law and also under the state law. It also includes public awareness to make sure that folks in the public really do know what trafficking is, that it isn't limited to foreign nationals, that under our Minnesota law, force, fraud, and coercion is not required, and it does not necessarily have to involve movement or transportation across a border. In addition, we would be creating, there is a bill that would create services, and we would, our program that we've created within that bill is modeled after the battered women's programs that we have in our current statutes in 611A. We think that that's an effective model. It's a model that is administered through the Office of Justice program. It is a competitive and transparent process, much like the one that is recommended by the federal government now providing the stimulus funds. And then finally, another component of the bill would provide access to public benefits and create a human trafficking waiver, much like the family violence waiver that you may be familiar with, so that victims of trafficking can have this waiver and have increased access to public benefits under the Minnesota Family Investment Program. So the two key pieces of the bill that we think could benefit from some of this federal stimulus money would be the training and public awareness and also the services for victims of human trafficking. One thing that I wanted to point out is that we believe that Minnesota has an obligation not only to use its own funds, but also that this federal stimulus money would be helpful, but we do have a responsibility to use our state government funds as well. Another key point to point out is that there has been a very long and proud tradition of dealing with prostitution and sex trafficking in Minnesota. As you probably know, in Minnesota, our law defines sex trafficking as receiving, recruiting, harboring, providing, or obtaining a person for the purposes of prostitution. And so under our state legal definition, we really can't separate prostituted victims from trafficked victims, as long as someone else has been involved in receiving or recruiting. And we have a long tradition of dealing with this. There are several organizations that have been working, and I'll just let Suzanne say one sentence for her piece. Sorry, I took more time, Suzanne. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Suzanne Keplinger. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis. We're working with the advocates on this bill. I would like to address briefly Representative Parnas made a comment about maintaining one-time investment of funds. Training and public awareness is a really good use of those dollars. One example of how that can be done very effectively is the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center is working with the Advocates for Human Rights, with Breaking Free in St. Paul. We're all doing work around trafficking and sex trafficking of both domestic and international victims on various levels. One of the things that we already have in place are partnerships with Minneapolis Police, Hennepin County Probation, Breaking Free is working with St. Paul Police. We have a coalition in place that could readily provide excellent training. We support the competitive RFP process that Ms. Boisvert talked about. And I just want to give one quick example about how this can be a very cost-effective strategy. We're currently conducting support groups with American Indian women who are incarcerated at the adult correctional facility in Plymouth on prostitution charges. We did a survey there, and the group that we're working with, 60% of these women identified having been trafficked into prostitution as juveniles. 25% of those women said this happened before the age of 12. If we have appropriately trained child welfare workers, medical professionals, law enforcement personnel, social service professionals, we can interrupt that cycle. We can get those girls into culturally-based appropriate interventions early on and avoid having them doing their 12th stint at the workhouse, which is a huge cost to the taxpayers. So we support the competitive RFP process. We think that training and public awareness is a critical component of more effectively addressing sex trafficking in our state.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? And Ms. Boisvert, is the program also is eligible for the stimulus money? She's nodding her head affirmative. That's Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a question for Ms. Boisvert. I understand the intent of the stimulus dollars, but I guess my question goes along with Representative Cornish. Can any of these dollars, all these programs that we're hearing, very important, I'm concerned about sustainability. Can any of these dollars be actually applied to that bottom line, to maybe reducing liabilities, to reducing long-term debt so that we put these programs in a better cash flow position so that we can sustain them?
We're going to get us from the chair up there.
Mr. Chair and Representative, dollars really have to be used on the allowable purpose item or budget items, and those are not allowable.
Is there anything else, closing comments you'd like to make? We have one more organization that wants to testify.
Mr. Chair, I do have a handout that I would move for the committee members highlighting some of the information that we've provided today.
Okay, very good. Ms. Ellison, Ms. Keplinger, I'm mispronouncing your name.
No, it's good. Keplinger,
that's right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next is the Survival Resources, Sue Maher, and Tim Lynch from the St. Paul Homicide Unit. I'm not sure what your rank is, sir, or what your title.
I'm an old guy now. I'm a senior commander.
Commander Lynch, welcome. Ms. Maher, welcome. Would you like to tell us that, you know, we've funded you in the past, I know, but if you could just tell us a little bit about your organization, and we'll see how you fit into the stimulus package.
I'm Susan Maher, and I'm here today as a homicide survivor. Survivor Resources was instrumental in my situation and that of many others. I'll just give you a really brief overview. 11 years ago, my son Joshua, at the age of 22, was kidnapped, bound, beaten, raped, stabbed, and then finally left to die in his car by eight individuals in St. Paul. And the day of my death notification, Survivor Resources came to my home and let me know that there was some support services available to people going through what my family and I were facing. And of course, we had no idea how to help ourselves, and they opened so many doors that were so necessary in putting together some healing after such a traumatic event. And Survivor Resources is there in St. Paul and Minneapolis right now, housed in the homicide departments of both cities, and in-kind donations come from the cities for the office space and the office equipment and that sort of thing. it also creates a connection then for the weekly support groups that go on between the officers and those working on the cases and the families involved. And I had a ton of questions and wondering how things were going to go and what things were happening during the 4 month process of concluding what happened to Josh and how the legal process would go into play. During that 4 months, I would have had no services whatsoever from any group or any agency or any state entity or city or county or anybody. There is victim witness services available to folks once they're in the legal system. But some cases aren't solved. And sometimes it takes a long time to solve those cases. And without survivor resources, there aren't services available to folks facing those kinds of things. Suicide is another instance where they're putting families back together after terrible trauma and putting them back into society with a healed and more productive possibility. I'm going to just turn it over to Mr. Lynch and hope that he can share with you their perspective.
Commander Lynch, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Lynch. I'm head of the Homicide Unit, Crime Lab and Property Units for St. Paul Police Department, and I'm also chair of the Board for Survivor Resources. Survivor Resources provides direct service to people whose family members have been killed or committed suicide or died in a violent accident. Last year alone, we served over 800 new clients in addition to 200 to 300 ongoing group clients that we deal with, and approximately 200 of those new clients last year came specifically from the 35W bridge collapse. What Survivor Resources does is provide services from literally from the time that family members are receiving notification of the death of their loved one, all the way through ongoing group support groups. Some of our clients have been coming for multiple years. Most clients are seen multiple times due to the complicated nature of recovery from this type of traumatic event. In addition to the wonderful work that they do helping people recover from this sort of thing and live productive lives again, for the police department, we also gain a huge benefit in that it allows us to keep our investigators emotionally separate from the family so they can conduct their investigations objectively. In addition to which, Survivor Resources has helped us to maintain contact with the families who often end up having more information about the crimes due to the nature of the crimes than the investigators are able to develop as representatives of the police. Literally, Survivor Resources helps us solve murders. I don't know how to put it any other way. We have a very small budget, about $325,000. We think that we also have between 10 and 12 volunteers that facilitate groups, and we feel that if we're able to get a piece of the stimulus funding for direct service to victims, that we would probably save one full-time staff that we added, I think it was late last year, or early last year. Excuse me. We added one staff early last year, and we'd probably lose that without additional stimulus funding.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Bovair, you can shake your head here. They're eligible for the VOCA section?
And for JAG.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Commander, thank you for your testimony.
Ms.
Maher, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to address come on up. I think we extended an invitation to you earlier, and you did not respond as far as we know, but come on up.
Chairman Phil Griffin, representing Big Brothers Big Sisters, and I'm sorry there was some miscommunication. We thought we had responded and sent an email. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Twin Cities, and I have with me today Gloria Lewis, who is the president and CEO of our organization. I know time is very short, and we'll try to be brief.
I apologize. We must have had a miscommunication, but if you can just, we've had Big Brothers Big Sisters here before, and you have been here before, so if you could just give us a 2 minutes of testimony will that be it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. We're very pleased to be here. We clearly understand, excuse me, I really have a cold this morning. We understand that the state is facing a difficult budget time. It's difficult decisions to make, and actually I really appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning. For the sake of time, I want to be brief with this, but I also want to give you the key points of our program and what we are doing. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Twin Cities. I want to also add that the program that we're here to talk about this morning is our Mentoring Children of Prisoners program. And after listening to other testimony this morning, I can clearly say to you that there are, in this state, 7,600 children in Minnesota who have at least one parent or one or more incarcerated in our criminal in the system, in our correction system. 70% of the prisoners who were surveyed in our system reported that they had a parent or a relative who had also been incarcerated. Our goal is to break that cycle, so the children will not go to prison and repeat what their parents are doing. We have been receiving for the last, over the last 2 years, $750,000 in total, $350,000, $325 a year from corrections. We want to continue to do that work. We are not sure that it will be in the budget for us again, and so I'm coming to you to say that of all the children that we work with, we have exceeded our goal with the Department of Corrections. We have 350 new matches. That's a big and a little, or an adult and a child match. That child's parent is incarcerated. Of those new matches, we are now continuing to support more than 550. So we've exceeded our goal with the money that we've received. I can tell you that 96% of our littles have improved in their confidence. We do 3 surveys a year to find out this information. 95% of the children who have parents incarcerated have improved their capacity for caring, their ability to show trust, to respect for others, and they have a positive attitude. Some of these children score higher than children who don't have a parent incarcerated. Which says that the work that we do with them is pretty intensive and that they are receiving what they need in order to succeed. I can tell you that 90% have improved their ability to avoid delinquency, and that's one of the big pieces that we want to share with you, that they have avoided, 93.5% have avoided early parenting. Those dollars do not have to come out for teen pregnancy and other issues that we know cost the state. 96.7% have avoided substance abuse. So what I want to say to you today is, very briefly, we need to continue to work with these young people. We are keenly aware of the network and other programs. Some of those people coming through the network, we are working with their children as well. We also are very pleased to say that we are not only just working in the Greater Twin Cities, but we share this work that they're working with us with Owatonna. And they have met in Owatonna. Every child that they have found, we've been able to help support Owatonna Big Brothers Big Sisters. So therefore, it's not just the Greater Twin Cities, it's also outside of the Twin Cities. So we are here to also seek funds from this substance, from this stimulus package as well.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. And I can't see you, Ms. Bovaire, but I'm assuming that Big Brothers Big Sisters also fits under the category of the JAG provision. Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your indulgence. Representative Hillstrom, who's the chief author of our bill, House File 963, to fund the continuing program of the MCOP, was here earlier and had to leave for another committee, but we appreciate your indulgence today.
Thank you. We decided not to hear any appropriation bills because we didn't have any money, but it's good that you are hearing your testimony and that we might be able to still find a way to fund some of these programs. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak? Thank you, Mr. Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. West, did you have a final question?
I did have one question for Ms. Bovaire. As I'm looking through the materials, I believe you said, Ms. Bovaire, that you're retaining $5.5 million for state use through the JAG funding. And how is that get distributed?
Ms. Bovaire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we intend on having a competitive process for that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. There's no other business before this committee. We are adjourned.